Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Tonight's program is Successful Strategies for Products That Win with Steve Blank. So we are very excited about this program tonight. Thank you all for being here and thank you everyone at home listening. I am going to give you a brief introduction to Steve and then bring Steve up here. Steve Blank is a retired serial entrepreneur who teaches, refines, writes, and blogs on customer development, a rigorous methodology he developed to bring the scientific method to the typically chaotic, seemingly disorganized startup process. Now teaching entrepreneurship at three major universities, Steve co-founded the first of eight startups after several years repairing fighter plane electronics in Thailand during the Vietnam War, followed by several years of defense electronics works for U.S. intelligence agencies in undisclosed locations. Steve arrived in Silicon Valley in 1978 as boom times began. His early startups included two semiconductor companies, Zilog and MIPS Computers, Convergent Technologies, a consulting stint for Pixar, a supercomputer firm Ardent, peripheral supplier Supermac, a military intelligence systems supplier ESL, and Rocket Science Games. Steve co-founded startup number 8, Epiphany, in his living room in 1996. In sum, two significant implosions, one massive dot-com bubble home run, several base hits, and immense learning leading to the book, The Four Steps. After 21 years driving 8 high-technology startups, today Steve teaches entrepreneurship to both undergraduate and graduate students at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, Stanford University's School of Engineering, and the Columbia-Berkeley Joint Executive MBA program. Let's welcome Steve Blank.
Well, I'm exhausted hearing all that. Just want you to know I'm standing in for Hillary. She couldn't make it tonight, so we're going to be talking about this. I thought the implosions were a little too kind. I actually described those failures as craters so deep they left their own iridium layer, which is, I think, a good characteristic for an entrepreneur who actually wanted to learn something. The official title of tonight's talk is Successful Strategies for Products That Win. But in reality, the talk is going to start with something from an old Buffalo Springfield song, and for those of you who could remember who that was, you're older than I am, called There's Something Happening Here, and what it is ain't exactly clear. It turns out that during revolutions, when there's enormous change at incredible speed, is the time we seem to be blind to it. And I just want to remind you all about what's gone on in the last 30 years or 40 years of entrepreneurship and what's happened in the last 5. So bear with me. So I'm going to tell this in a few short stories and then spend some time talking actually about customer development and business models. But first, a key idea is for the first 3 or 4 decades of entrepreneurship as we know it, startups were constrained, that is, limited. They were limited by a set of interesting things. One is, it cost a lot of money in the old days to get a product out the door. If you were making software or hardware, the first thing you needed to build or buy were mini computers or mainframes, and they might cost a couple $100,000. And then you needed to buy a couple $100,000 or maybe $1 million worth of software. Later on, you needed to buy Sun workstations, and just the hardware and software cost of getting your startup up and running before you could even develop anything cost millions of dollars. And then when you started developing, it took a long time to get the first product. Engineering would put together a set of feature specs, go into development mode, and what we would call first customer ship might be certainly a year, if not years, from the day we first started. Customer adoption. The original customers for entrepreneurial startups in Silicon Valley were first government defense contractors for microwave components in the 50s and 60s. Semiconductor companies sold to those same places. Eventually, they sold to corporations whose adoption cycles were still measured in certainly a year or two or longer. And so customer adoption was slow. The notion of going to, you know, a couple of 100,000 customers might be a decade process. And there was a high startup failure rate. Startups failed because startups failed. There was no real science about entrepreneurship. In fact, if you want to know why a startup failed, you talk to the last VP of sales who blamed it on engineering, and then you could talk to the VP of engineering who would tell you that it was marketing, and marketing would tell you it was the VP of sales. And we'd have a kind of a long circle of no one really understood what made the difference between success and failure. Venture capitalists all kind of wore white shoes and lived in the same building in Sand Hill Road. There was a limited number of them. They were a small, clubby group, and while they looked serious and well-dressed, they were as equally insane as the entrepreneurs they were funding, because where else in the world would you give money to 20-some-odd-year-olds and not expect them to go to Brazil? In fact, that's still a continuing characteristic of Silicon Valley that I love. You could give people bags of money, and instead of leaving to enjoy it somewhere with that doesn't have an extradition clause, they would rather spend it working 24/7. I'm not sure I understand that. And innovation was limited to a few regions. When I came out to Silicon Valley, it was Silicon Valley and Boston, and it wasn't clear which region would actually win. Just as an aside, for those of you who want to understand at least why it was Silicon Valley and not Boston, a professor at UC Berkeley, Annalise Saxenian, has written the definitive book called Regional Advantage. And if you all haven't read it, it at least describes, I think, about 90% of why Silicon Valley eventually won. But these were the constraints to entrepreneurship as we knew it, going into the 21st century. I just want to observe that almost all at once that there really is something happening here. And it's that these startup constraints are all being removed almost at once that I believe is creating an entrepreneurial explosion. Let me just use the same model and explain. Now, if you're an internet startup, you could get a first product to market on a credit card. On a credit card. Doesn't mean you could do the same thing if you want to build a semiconductor fab, but there's now an entire industry that could start a company, a substantive company, on credit cards. Maybe you're going into your parents' credit cards, but they're credit cards. Two is, there are now tools that allow you to do that, not just cheaply, but quickly. And there's a whole engineering methodology that says instead of building the entire product on day one with what's called a waterfall method, we could use an iterative and incremental way to build products called agile development, which has been a radical breakthrough in thinking. And we could get the first products out in months, if not years. And by the way, the first people to do this wasn't an internet startup. Agile engineering was actually first invented by, of all people, Toyota, with the lean startup manufacturing model in the 1960s and 70s. There's a great story, and it's completely irrelevant, but I'll tell it here anyway because I love it. The American car companies in the 70s and 80s are getting their rear ends beaten in by the Japanese. They're limiting Japanese imports, and the Japanese get around that by actually building better factories in the United States. Another story, but finally the Japanese invite the U.S. car manufacturing executives to come visit the Japanese manufacturing plants to see what their secret is. And boy, the U.S. executives are, okay, we're going to go find out the big secret. Now, you have to understand that this time, continual war with labor that the U.S. car manufacturers had. So everything they saw was kind of viewed through that filter. They step into the first Japanese car manufacturing plant, and all they see is a sea of robots. Robots, robots, robots building cars. U.S. car executives look at each other and go, we got it. This is the answer. Not understanding that there was something much, much deeper about lean manufacturing, they go, it's all about robots. They come back, and General Motors, by itself, in the next decade, spends $8.5 billion on robots from, guess where? Japan. never understanding that the robots were just symptomatic of a much deeper and fundamental way to build cars and automobiles quickly and efficiently called lean manufacturing. In any case, back to startups. One of the things that just is mind-bending was it might have taken you a decade, to get to 10,000 or 100,000 customers. There are now internet startups with 500 million customers in 5 years. Almost as good as McDonald's. Right? Just an amazing, amazing set of adoption. We've gone from government to selling to companies to now consumer being the first adopter of new technologies. And for the first time, we're starting to understand the root causes of what makes some startups succeed and some startups fail. And this, to me, is kind of some of the most exciting knowledge that we've gathered. We're now able to look back and kind of like slap our forehead and go, duh, here's some insights of what we've seen. And we'll be talking about that. Risk capital is a fancy word for venture capital. The pool of risk capital used to be limited to just VCs with formal funds. In the last decade, this pool has exploded with a new class of investors, super angels, angel investors. Everybody wants to write checks to entrepreneurs because the cost of entry is so low and the payback for success is so high. Everybody wants to write the next $100,000 check to the next Google or Facebook. And more importantly, it's gone global. Where entrepreneurship used to be Silicon Valley or Boston, it's everywhere. It's in Israel. It's in Finland. It's in Chile. It's certainly in China. It's in India. There are now innovation clusters popping up all over the world, and that's exciting. And so the world has really kind of changed. And so I believe this is leading to a new wave of entrepreneurship like nothing we've ever seen. I think it's probably the most exciting time ever to be an entrepreneur. But tonight's talk is going to focus on this box, on how do we lower startup failure rates and what is it that we've learned in the last 30 or 40 years about entrepreneurship, why do startups fail, and why do they succeed? So that's the next story. And this starts from just a generic observation that not all startups are equal. I grew up in New York City with a set of parents who both came over to the United States as immigrants. In fact, they came over in steerage, in the bottom of the boat, just before World War II. And they remember not only passing under the Statue of Liberty, but going through Ellis Island. They moved into the Lower East Side of New York, and their dream, after they met and got married, was to open a grocery store. That was the American dream for my parents. They could actually own their own store and be masters of their own fate. And so I grew up thinking that my parents did a startup, and they were entrepreneurs. And in fact, their startup served known customers with a known product. Hey, what do our neighbors need to eat? Gee, we could supply that. And their goal, their revenue goal, was to feed our family, which most, but not every week, they actually accomplished. Some weeks, we'd be eating the stuff on the shelf. And their goal was not to take over the world, but take their little startup grocery store and turn it into a profitable small business. So their exit criteria of being a startup was they found the profitable business model by figuring out what their neighbors needed to eat and what didn't move off the shelf. They did it with an existing team, my mother and father, and eventually my sister and I. And if they made $1 million in their entire lives, that was a lot of money. But small businesses, grocery stores, consultants, barbers, carpenters, plumbers, etc. These people truly do startups. They truly are entrepreneurs. And in fact, the U.S. is a nation of small businesses. There are 5.7 million small businesses under 500 employees. These make up 99.7% of all companies in the United States, and they employ over 50% of all non-governmental workers. Why mention them? Well, again, when people outside of innovation centers like Silicon Valley, San Francisco, Boston, New York, etc., talk about an entrepreneur, here's who they're talking about. And these people are entrepreneurial, but they don't do what we do. I'll also mention another group. Large companies have entrepreneurs. During a large company's life, they grow by innovating around their core product. A guy named Clayton Christensen, a professor at Harvard 15 years ago, basically called this sustaining innovation. Large corporations are great at doing variants around existing products and to known customers and known product feature needs. Think of Microsoft Word version 47. Right? It's perfect. Microsoft knows you were dying to have left-handed footnotes in Arabic. Right? New version, there you are, etc. But large companies in their lifetime almost inevitably are threatened by technology changes, new competitors, new customers, new markets that just never existed. Even the most innovative companies are threatened by these changes. Think of Google, who not more than 3 years ago was considered the most innovative company in Silicon Valley and is now losing employees to another startup doing something that Google never did before, which is social networking. That is, Facebook emerged, created a new category that Google never had to even deal with. And that's called disruptive innovation. So large companies have to deal with new markets, new technology, new customers. And how large companies do that is two ways. One is they try to build innovation internally, Google saying we're going to do our own social network, or they go out and acquire either talent or products or customers or complete businesses. In fact, this acquisition of disruptive innovation is what's fueling the mergers and acquisition wave in Silicon Valley. The technology changes are happening so fast that large companies, to keep up, are buying innovative new startups. So startups and innovation also occur in large companies. So far, small business innovation and startups, large company innovation. But here's what we do in Silicon Valley. And it's what I call a scalable startup. A scalable startup is designed from day one to do two things. It's to solve for unknown customers and unknown features, and more importantly, the founders on day one have woken up the first day and said, we're taking over the world. We are going to be bigger than any company that ever existed. And if we could think of anything else we want, we're going to want that too. Anybody thinking that way? Raise your hand. Good. You're doing a scalable startup. Imagine someone who woke up in the morning and said, I'm going to put Detroit completely out of business, and while I'm doing that, I'm going to launch rockets at the same time. Now, would you call for a straitjacket, or would you fund this guy? Anybody know who it was? Elon Musk did Tesla and SpaceX and hit both of them out of the park, right? Tesla is probably the first commercially successful automotive company, and SpaceX did two out of two in launching the first private spacecraft into orbit, and the last one actually recovered a payload successfully, things that only four other governments have done. Yay, startups. That is a scalable startup vision. And it turns out, scalable startups look for, have I found my business model? Am I going after a large enough market, typically half a billion or a billion? And can it grow, can the company itself grow to $100 million a year? These types of startups are designed to grow big and typically require what I call risk capital. Risk capital is a fancy word for venture capital. Which, by the way, in the 1950s, venture capital was actually originally named adventure capital. And the Wall Street people said, no, 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 no. You can't use that. It's crazy enough that you're going to give money to 20-year-olds and they're, no, no, no. Why don't we shorten it? And so they said, okay, it's venture capital. But the reason why they could attract venture capital and small businesses cannot is that their vision, if they're right, is that they could have a large company that's valued such that investors who put money in at a low value could get what I call an obscene return. No VCs are investing to get a fair return. They're looking for obscene returns. Why? Because every investment they look at, they have to say, can this pay back my entire fund? And so their investment vision is tied at the hip with the entrepreneur's vision. And that's what makes this such an unlikely but wonderful pairing. But these scalable startups are what Silicon Valley means when they say the word startup. And this is a big idea. Small business entrepreneurship, yeah, they do startups. Large companies, they do startups too. But when Silicon Valley talks about startups, this is what we're talking about. Founders with huge vision, who typically need to raise venture capital, who hopefully could return enormous amounts to their investors. Now, by the way, my definition of a startup is a little different than ones you might have heard of. My definition of what a scalable startup is as follows. A scalable startup is a temporary organization used to search for a scalable and repeatable business model. And it's worth thinking about what this means. Number one, temporary organization. I will tell you that there is no such thing as a 12-year-old startup. There's a 2-year-old startup and attached to a 10-year-old failure. And some of you aren't laughing. You should all be laughing. Two is, its job is to search. A startup and founders are great at searching. What are you searching for? We'll be talking about that in some detail. But you're great at looking for things that no one quite knows are there yet. Who are the customers? How should we price it? What are the features that matter? Entrepreneurs are spectacular at searching. And what you're searching for is something that could scale, grow big, and can be repeatable. And it could be described in something we'll talk about called the business model. Now, just as an aside, there's one thing I just wanted to add because I have a crowd here that a good number of you are doing. How many of you are doing startups? All right. So here's a secret slide that no VC will ever send you. Now, if you remember back here, I drew a diagram that you go from startup to large company. And gee, life would be great if the world actually works like this. You do a startup, you find a business model, and immediately they hold a quick parade around the boardroom to pin a medal on you for finding that business model, and then you grow into a large company. But in fact, the world works completely different. There's an intermediate step between startup and large company. It's called the transition. And I have never gotten that memo from the VCs. And the transition basically says, well, a startup is to search, the transition is to build, and a company is to execute. But more specifically, the transition is when the founders depart. And depart is a nice euphemism for you were probably holding on to the door frame when they were like pushing you out. And also, some of you are laughing and some of you are like crying because you remember what that felt like. But here's why. I've now decoded what goes on, and it's unfortunate we never really have this conversation. World-class entrepreneurs are great at doing something different on Monday at 9 than they are at 3, than they are at Tuesday at 4. I mean, they could be flying here, going here, telling engineering to do this, working with HR, you know, hiring the world's best employee, taking out the trash, cooking dinner for, you know, the other employees, etc. You do everything. But your job, truly, is to find something that's repeatable, that all of a sudden, gee, the next day, customers behaved exactly like they did the day before, and they actually gave us money. Look, the next day, they gave us more money. Look, we keep making more money, and we're doing the same thing day after day. Yay, we found a repeatable model. And what happens when that, you're excited, because you can't wait to tell your board. And so what happens is you're prepping for that board meeting, and you're saying, we have found the model. You think they're going to pin the medal on you. Your board member drives into the parking lot. Anybody know how many boards a Silicon Valley venture capitalist sits on? Yeah, so about 10, average 10, some 8 to 12. So remember, they pull into the parking lot. They have to look at the sign to remember what the name of the company is. And then they get out their smartphone to figure out your name, and they probably have a little picture next to it and with a little score, 1 to 10, whether they like you. You know, and they're really good at faking it. Oh, name of you know, CEO here. Hey, Joe, good to see you. And they're going, boy, who is this guy? And they found out they were in the wrong office. But they go into your boardroom. You're ready for the award, and you tell them, look, we found the profitable model, etc. And all of a sudden, they start looking at you from head to toe and toe to head. And they actually walk around you a bit and start looking at you from another angle. And you're getting kind of uncomfortable because this might be a little more personal than you were used to. And what's going on here? For the first time, VCs who were happy to let the entrepreneur out there bounce against the wall, fly around the world, do whatever they want in searching, now realizes that he might have a profitable venture. And all of a sudden, there's more risk rather than less. Why? Why is there risk now? All of a sudden, your goal, which was to search, now needs to transition into execution. And world-class searchers are almost always, though not never, almost always horrible at execution. Big thing to know. And just, I won't make you raise your hands, but I always do this test in my class. There's a funny correlation between entrepreneurs who grew up in dysfunctional families and those who are successful startup CEOs. Some of you are looking at each other going, oh. It turns out it's the first place in your life that if you're a survivor of a dysfunctional family, that you have an edge. No, seriously, I'm like a self-admitted survivor. It's because I grew up where chaos was the norm, and I had to learn how to focus with what was actually, you know, trench warfare and then, you know, bombs going off every day. And because I was capable of doing that, a startup seemed like even a calmer environment than the place I grew up in. World-class entrepreneurs have that ability, and I was just mentioning that those who come from dysfunctional families actually do great until the transition. Because all of a sudden, things have gone from chaos to now they require repeatable order and execution. What do you think those kinds of founders do to their own companies? They throw hand grenades into their own organizations to keep chaos going. Any of you ever work for those people? Oh, look, and so how many of you are those? No, now you can understand why, by the way. It's kind of interesting. It's the psychodrama that here's another thing we don't tell each other. And again, by the way, for the rest of you who came from a normal family, no, it's not a requirement to come from a dysfunctional family, but you should know that that has been your competitive edge. So, as I said, you fail if you remain a startup. So I just want to give you a little view. Here's what else we've learned. So next story. How are we doing on time? Are we doing okay? It's why startups are not small versions of large companies. As I mentioned, startups are about the search for a business model, right? We just established that entrepreneurs are great at searching for all the unknowns. I just want to remind you, large companies are about the execution. A large company, Walmart, does not want the new store manager to come up with a new way to set up the shelves. Hey, look what I did overnight. We moved all the stuff here. It's more efficient. You know? It's like, no, why don't you do your own startup, but you're not going to do that at Walmart. We want people who know how to execute. In a large corporation, you need to know how to do accounting. Income statement, balance sheets, cash flow. Anybody know how to do that, right? Every board meeting I ever went in a startup, my VCs would ask me for income statement, balance sheet, and cash flow. What do you think my income statement was on month one? Zero. Okay, but here's the paperwork we just spent 6 hours preparing it for you. Okay, next board meeting, month two. What's my income statement? Zero, but here's the paperwork. Month three, here's the paperwork. Does anybody see a pattern here? Oh, gee, we just accomplished whatever we were supposed to do as a board in a startup? No. These are great metrics for how to manage large corporations. You cannot run a large distributed organization with hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people without accounting. But when the same methods and the same financial metrics are used while you're searching for a business model, not only are they destructive, they just mean your board doesn't understand what their job or your job is. Yeah, you want to know one metric of traditional accounting is how much cash do you have left? And what's your burn rate? And when do the wings, you know, fall off when you hit the ground? But the rest of the metrics are, if you're on the web, what's my customer acquisition cost? Do I have any viral coefficient? What's my customer lifetime value, average selling price, burn rate, user acquisition? I'm looking for what metrics are important to my business. Make sense? Sales. In a large company, anybody ever see a large major company VP of sales? Fortune 100? How tall are they? 6'4", right. That's the exact height. What color is their hair? Blonde or silver. And if it wasn't one of those, they dye it. Okay? What's their golf handicap? Okay? 5, right? So we, and by the way, while it's a stereotype, it's pretty close to truth. I don't know what that meant, but it would sound good. large company execs and their sales staffs truly know how to do great stuff. While we laugh about them in startups, they know how to meet a revenue goal, know how to manage sales organizations, and their sales teams know how to sell off of price lists and data sheets and do wonderful things. And every startup I used to be in would go and say, okay, we got it. We need to hire the best salespeople from the top 1% club of the, you know, whatever industry we were in. And so we'd hire a recruiter, and they'd tell us all the wonderful stuff, and this was the world's best salesperson, et cetera, and we'd hire them into the sales force of our startup, and they'd melt down. Smoke would come out of their ears. Why? Because, like, I'd pull up in the parking lot with them calling on a customer, and they'd go, okay, where's the presentation? And I go, well, we got 15 minutes. I haven't written it yet. And like they go, what? Well, what are the features? Well, I don't know. What do you think they should be? What? Well, how much are we going to charge? I don't know. What do you think they'll take? No, we can't do that. There's a small class of world-class salespeople who know how to execute who can make the transition to search. The problem is we use the same titles. Sales says sales in a large company. It says sales in a small company. Gee, aren't we just a smaller version of a large company? My observation is that's one of the leading causes of death of startups is confusing the titles. They're not the same. Startups are not small versions of large companies. Engineering has the same problem. World-class engineering VP in a large company knows how to take market requirements documents, go into what's called waterfall development, spec out the entire feature set of the product, shut the doors, and then go into a year's worth of development. And you could tell they're in waterfall because they have the world's best quality assurance and technical pubs departments. These people also melt down, or melt down your company, because it's exactly how you don't want to build products in a startup. You want to build products incrementally and agilely. And there's a term for this type of engineering called agile development. And it's about learning what the minimum feature set is and how to release software in chunks rather than assuming you know everything a customer might want in day one. And we'll talk some more about this. The last piece is company's plan. A business plan comes from a large company. When we want to do the new version of an existing product, that is Microsoft Word 48, we know who the customers are. We know what the features are. We know the markets. We could draw the business model. A business plan makes all the sense in the world. You're going to hear me talk about this a lot, but in a startup, a business plan is death. Death. What you need is a business model. Now, I'm going to be talking about this one in some detail. And in fact, it brings us to the next story about why startups fail. It turns out more startups fail from a lack of customers than from a failure of product development. And this is just an amazing statement, given that at Silicon Valley we take more technical risk per square foot than anywhere else in the world, yet at the end of the day, products fail because we don't find enough customers. And those of you who are engineers feeling good, I didn't say products are delivered on time. I just said they don't fail for that. They mostly fail from a lack of customers and markets. But we don't have any processes for customer development. We have lots of processes to manage engineering, product development. And in fact, if you think about the traditional product introduction model, it looks something like this. It's the leading cause of startup death. Anybody ever see this? You draw a concept, seed round, product development, alpha test, beta test, first customership. I used to tell my class even the waiters in San Francisco could draw this diagram until one of them said, we used to be .com CEOs, that's why we're waiters in San Francisco. So I promised I'd never say that again. The product introduction model has two implicit assumptions here. One is that you as the founder know what the customer problem is. Well, I have a vision. That's what I'm supposed to have. I'm a visionary. I'm a founder. You told me I'm supposed to be thinking about billion-dollar market. I know what the end looks like. Right here is why startups fail. Because you believe this faith-based vision is all you need. You will then spec every product feature and go into product development. This is what kills startups. Assuming that startups are simply a faith-based activity that don't need to be replaced with facts. And in fact, this then drives a whole set of hiring. Marketing gets hired, sales gets hired, business development gets hired, engineering gets hired, all aiming for launch and first customership. This is all driven, by the way, from a wonderful creative writing exercise that you're taught to do from day one. This. It's the business plan. Now, let me list all the great things about a business plan for your startup. Okay, we're done. And let me use that to tell you how startups succeed. No business plan survives first contact with customers. That's why business plans are great for large companies that have existing customers and markets and fail in startups. So what we need to do is replace it with a search for a business model. And we've used this word, business model, so many times, I'm feeling like a professor at Stanford and Berkeley. Oh, I am a professor at Stanford and Berkeley. But the joke is, you could get three professors in a room and use the word business model and come out with 12 descriptions until now. Turns out there's a guy named Alexander Osterwalder who wrote a book called Business Model Design, and I love it because it's all about pictures, and so you should have a copy, who says, I could describe any business in 9 boxes. One is, who are the customers? Two is, what am I selling to these customers? What's the value proposition? Three is, how do I get the product to them? What's the channel? Four is, how do I create demand? What kind of relationship do I have with customers? Five is, how do I make money? What kind of revenue streams do I have? What key resources do I need? What things do I need to do, manufacturing, et cetera? What are the key activities? Do I need any key partners? And finally, how much money is this all costing me to do? These 9 components add up into a business model. Every startup needs to draw their business model. And I'll show you that basically, startups search for a business model with something called a customer development process. It's the part that I teach. Customer development is the part where startups search for a business model. And this search is done by the founders. Anybody ever been a founder of a startup? Okay. Let me tell you a funny story. I remember being a founder. of a video game company. In fact, there are some people in the room who survived that crater, barely. And we thought we had the world's best video game products. They were awesome. I hired a VP of marketing who went out, because he came from the video game industry, and actually went out and talked to customers, showed them our games. And he came back and said, Steve, we're in trouble. I said, what are you talking about? Team, these are not only great video games, we're on the cover of Wired magazine. They say we're geniuses. How can they be? They don't know what they're talking about. Get out of the building and talk to some more people. Came back again. He said, Steve, not only are they terrible, they're not going to buy any. I said, Dean, you're just not selling it hard enough. Third time he came back and said the same thing. What do you think I did? I fired him, of course. He clearly wasn't reading Wired. Right? You know, I blew $35 million of somebody's money of not getting out of the building and listening. Now imagine if I would have went out the first time and would have heard that. What would have I said first time I heard it? You're wrong. Can't be. Second time, what would I have said? Maybe. Third time, oh gosh. I mean, you can't deny it when you hear it yourself. This is about human beings and wiring. You can't outsource customer development. You simply can't. It's not that you're not smart. I could still remember all the words my VP of marketing, Dean, who I fired over telling me the truth, and I know I could remember them because they were the truth, and cognitive dissonance just kicked in. It can't be right. My partner says we are creating, the next Shakespearean, game in 12 acts. We were wrong. But we didn't go out and hear it ourselves. So customer development replaces this product introduction model with a four-step process: customer discovery, customer validation, customer creation, and company building. And the key tenets here are pretty simple. It simply says, stop selling, start listening, test your hypotheses. Now, by the way, you're going to hear me say this word a lot now, hypotheses. And I use it in Berkeley and Stanford because those students pay an exorbitant amount of money to hear big words. But what's the real word for hypothesis? A guess. And in fact, if we weren't being broadcasting, I would actually tell you they were an effing guess, right? But we're just guessing. A startup on day one is a faith-based activity built around a series of guesses. Your job is to get out of the building with continuous discovery and turn those guesses into facts as fast as possible. And it's done by the founders. And how we're going to do it is take that business model diagram, put it in a business model canvas that you could download from Alexander Osterwalder's website, put it on your wall, and start testing every one of the hypotheses along the 9 business model boxes. And your job, using a customer development process, is to simply get out of the building and test each one of these. Yeah, I think the customers are X. Great, thanks for your opinion. Now get the heck out of the building and actually talk to them. Well, I think the pricing model should be X. Thanks for your opinion. Go out and try to sell it at that price. Finally, one of the most interesting observations about startups is that most of the time, your hypotheses are wrong. Now, it took us 40 years to actually understand this. Anybody ever been in a startup board meeting right after the product launch? Anybody? Right? It's exciting. Everybody's high-fiving each other. The board's feeling good. Everybody, yeah, it's great. Great launch. Oh, look at blog and news and... Next month, board has the meeting. How we doing? Oh, man, great leads and, people are hitting the website or we got, great, pipeline is the normal word from VP of sales. Next month, how we doing? Pipeline. Board is, next month after that. How we doing? Pipeline. And I think VCs go to a school because they learn how to cock their eyebrows collectively at about a 15-degree angle and cock their head at about 30 degrees and look at the CEO simultaneously. It's kind of like, really? And all of a sudden, people are concerned. Next board meeting, you open the door, and no one is sitting next to the VP of sales. In fact, the stench of death is in the room. And I don't know how they do it, but there's a flaming sword over her head. Next board meeting, the VP of sales is gone. Who's there next? New VP of sales. What do you think the new VP of sales does? Does she do the exact same strategy as the last VP of sales? No. No, not if she's intelligent. She'll go, well, that didn't work. I need a new strategy. Guess what we just did? We did what we call a pivot. That is, we went back, said that didn't work, we're going to do something else. But instead of building it into the process, we pivoted in the past by firing executives. Because if that didn't work, who gets fired next? VP of marketing. After that, who gets fired next? VP of sales. All right, we'll throw the VP of engineering in there, except they always get promoted to the CTO, just so they could explain where the code is. I left it here yesterday. It turns out this idea of the pivot just says, no, startups are mostly wrong. So instead of like acting like a large company where it was just an execution problem and you fail, gee, you must have been an idiot because it was a known process, in a startup, we're just going to assume we're going to fail and build that in as an iteration loop. Whoa, that's a big idea. This is, in fact, iteration without crisis, and it's what makes us fast, agile, and opportunistic. So to wrap up, startups are not small versions of large companies. Traditional big company planning tools fail, and startups are built on a set of hypotheses that you need to test. Business models help you keep score, and customer development is the actual process you do need to test. Let me just ask our host, do we have time for three more slides?
Yeah.
We do? Uh-huh. Okay. So I have this. This is kind of like the encore part of the, if I have a second. So here's why startups aren't run by accountants. The inventor of the modern corporation was this guy. Anybody know who he is? Does this look like a serious guy? For those of you at home, you can't see his face. But this is the most tight whatever person I've ever seen. His name was Alfred P. Sloan. Anybody know who Alfred P. Sloan was? Who was he? Founder of General Motors, right. Alfred P. Sloan, founder of General Motors, really is the inventor of the modern corporation. His company was bought by General Motors. He basically built GM into a powerhouse. He was the president and the chairman, and he basically took the cost accounting system that DuPont invented in the early 20th century, and it allowed General Motors to run distributed divisions and, adopted by other companies, turned the 20th century into the American century of distributed manufacturing. Things are named after him. MIT Sloan School, Sloan Foundation, Sloan Kettering Institute. Anybody know Sloan Kettering? Who was Kettering? His VP of engineering, of course. Now, one of the interesting things is you look at this guy and you go, whoa, I don't want to be in a meeting with him. You know, this is a serious guy. Except you notice he was president and chairman. And if you know anything about the history of corporations in the United States, you were taught Sloan. But who was the founder of General Motors? Bet you never heard of this guy. His name was Billy Durant. And if you look at the picture, which again, those of you who can't see at home, this is the happiest looking guy you've ever seen. He looks like a founder. He's having a good time. Billy Durant was the leader in manufacturing horse-drawn buggies in Flint, Michigan in the last half of the 19th century. And he was sitting on a bar with his other manufacturing buddies one day and saw the funniest thing he's ever seen. Somebody had strapped this one-cylinder engine to one of the buggies, and it was like chugging down the road. And his friends were so like hysterical, they fell off their bar stools. All of them except Durant, who looked at that buggy with the one-cylinder engine and said, "We're out of business." And so Durant sold his entire buggy business and started investing in technology startups at the time, wasn't a technologist, and started buying up small automobile companies and put them together in a conglomerate called General Motors. And because he was a crazy entrepreneur, he'd always run out of money, he'd been doing crazy investments, and he was fired by the board in 1910. Durant says, "Oh yeah, I'm starting another company." And he started one which he called Chevrolet. Chevrolet grows bigger than General Motors. Durant takes it public and buys up all the GM stock and throws out his board of directors. Yeah. Runs GM for another 10 years until the money people he put on the board called the DuPonts finally throw him out for the second and last time. And when he's fired by the board again, GM in today's dollars is a $3.6 billion company. But here's what's interesting. Durant versus Sloan. Sloan dies rich, honored, and famous. Durant dies managing a bowling alley penniless in 1947. No one's ever heard of his name. This was the accountant. You are here. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to remind our listening audience at home that we are the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Successful Strategies for Products That Win with Steve Blank. And I would like to mention that Steve is the author of Four Steps to the Epiphany. We don't have books for sale tonight, but Steve told me that if you go to steveblank.com, his website, you guys here tonight and listening at home are eligible for the student discount to buy his book, Four Steps to the Epiphany. So also, Steve, I was asked by a couple people, are these slides going to be available online somewhere?
They were just posted on slideshare.net under Steve Blank. Go search for my name and you'll see the Commonwealth Club presentation.
Okay, great. Well, we're going to take audience questions now for about 15 minutes. So if you'd like to come to the mic, please speak into the mic and please don't make an audience statement. This is audience questions.
Steve, Dan Monroe, any insight at all on customer development for healthcare?
I won't give you the political answer. You know, each market and each segment has, the basic customer development rules are the same. You know, the time to market, the types of things you need to do are different. Obviously, if you're an internet-based startup, you could get answers almost online. Depending on what you're offering for healthcare, requires physically touching and talking to people, and it could be immensely complicated. So it's a generic question. I'm not sure how to give you more detail. I should use this to just mention something interesting, which took me a while to understand. Customer development is essentially a risk reduction technology for markets and customer segments that have customer and market risk. Let's use the extreme. Web 2.0, with all due respect to any of the engineers in the room, is not a technology risk, at least until it scales. It's all about customers and market. On the other hand, if you're doing a biotech startup doing a cure for cancer, it's 12 years before you get to FDA phase one. There's no customer and market risk for the first 10 years or so. It's, in fact, all about technology risk. Reading my book is like, you know, it might be great, but it gets in your way. Your job is to, you know, figure out how to make the technology risk go away as soon as possible. There are businesses that combine both technology and market risk, doing a new semiconductor architecture. The first year or two is whether the chip would work at all. That's pure technology risk. But even when you get it working, you still don't have a business until you get design wins. Now you have customer and market risk. So without knowing about your detail about healthcare is whether it was a technology risk, customer and market risk, et cetera. Next question.
Hi, Steve. Jesse Katz. Can you talk about the factors you look for in an engineering team or a CTO for a Web 2.0 company?
You know, that assumes I actually invest rather than teach. You know, I tend to look for, and again, the question is much better put to somebody who knows something, but since I'm up here, I've never hesitated to fill up space, so I will. But I look for teams that at least have a understanding that they know what they don't know. The biggest danger, as I said early on, is believing that you could spec the entire product up front and immediately go into waterfall development. There are some segments of the business where it is an existing market and you can kind of say, yes, we're going to take this market and do this better or faster. But most of the time, you're just trying to understand what customers want. And so what you really want is somebody who very quickly knows how to get to a minimum feature set. And that really is a skill that's just been emerging in the last couple of years. And so if you asked me, I'd be looking for people who understand the methodologies of getting small tests out there, whether it's a web product or even a physical product. What's the minimum thing we could do to get some relevant tests about whether these are the right customers, right pricing, right channel, et cetera?
Hi, Steve. Ken Fromm. Can you talk about discovering market segments and any stories you might have on which ones you hypothesized were correct or were the immediate ones and turned out to be longer term, and which ones might have surprised you by being earlier adopters than you had thought?
Sure. Well, let's see. I mentioned video games. Video games was a great lesson for me. And every once in a while, I see other technologists falling into this trap. Video game business was kind of like the real estate business. It was a hits-based business that was only ancillarily had something to do with technology. It was all about entertainment and understanding what made great games and made people happy, and et cetera. And we thought we were in the technology business. So that was just not only a miss for a segment, it was just not understanding what business we were in. I did a company called Ardent, which was a supercomputer company, which turned out to be the intersection of the null set of two markets. We thought we were going to attack the mini supercomputer market, which existed for a while, and then attack the graphics workstation market and find the intersection of all the people who needed both. And it turned out, I think there were 20 of those. Unfortunately, our forecast required 4,000. There were other things that just got adopted slow and then just took off. MIPS computers, which was a completely new chip architecture, its adoption rate was kind of interesting. Its architecture is still around after 25 years. Next question.
Hi, Lydia Sugarman. I have two questions. Where was the grocery store? On the Lower East Side. And you wrote yesterday or the day before about Startup America. And I'd just be interested in hearing your comments about Startup America and the Startup Visa,
right,
if that's still even viable.
Sure. So for those of you who know, the administration and the White House just had a great press event this week about entrepreneurship, what I would actually call scalable startup entrepreneurship, and the initiatives that the White House and the administration were putting in. And it, in fact, engaged, I think, some of the best and the brightest of the entrepreneurial community, Carl Schramm, Steve Case, the founder of Techstars, Brad Feld. And there were a set of exciting announcements. I was just a little skeptical, not because I don't hope it succeeds. I actually hope it does. It's just that these people seem to have come in to visit rather than been part of a policy part of the administration. So one is I believe that for entrepreneurship, small business, job growth in the United States, that the people who make policy all can't be lawyers, bankers, Wall Street executives, large corporate execs, that we really need a place at the table. And while the people who came in for that announcement were perfect, we should not have let them left and should have given them offices. Two is you got a little taste of what at least my view of what makes up American entrepreneurship. It's from small business through scalable startups to large corporate entrepreneurship. Also includes social entrepreneurship. Without understanding that spectrum and without being able to articulate it, I'm hard-pressed to understand how we could jumpstart a integrated economic policy that addresses this from beginning to end if you can't describe it. I made that observation, as somebody nicely pointed out, on my blog, which is steepblank.com, and you could, in fact, if you want to read the 4,000 ways somebody could personally crater their own companies, you'll get a set of war stories and then some observations about customer development and agile development and the future of entrepreneurship and entrepreneurship education on that blog as well. So thank you for asking.
Hi, Steve. Nathan Beckard. Your blog is great, by the way.
Did I pay you to say that?
What's that?
It
really is. When founders get out of the building and start testing their hypotheses, any tips for avoiding red herrings, false positives? You talk to 10 different customers and 10 different answers.
This really is both fact and philosophy. There are some people who believe that you could actually get out of the building either physically or virtually, and this is just a numerical addition problem. You know, I spoke to 47 people, and 39% said they wanted feature X or Y or Z. I don't believe so. Maybe there are, but it's not the type of entrepreneurship I'm talking about. I believe every one of you are artists, not accountants. That entrepreneurship is done by artists. And then getting out of the building is to inform your opinion, not to do a focus group. Do focus groups in large companies for second products. In startups, we're betting on your instinct about running a pattern recognizer, about a whole set of data. And as far as I'm concerned, you could come back and say, everyone hated it, but here's why we're still doing it. That's still valid. But now you could actually say why. And we're going to force you to articulate what your supposed gut says. Your gut is nothing more than pattern recognition going on in a background that's not yet connected to your mouth. And we're going to connect it to your mouth. But to me, entrepreneurship is not a math problem. It's an information collection and an enrichment problem.
Hi, Steve. Murali Devarakonda. I have a question about, actually, two-part question very quickly. One about how does customer development apply to bootstrapping startups as opposed to venture startups? And number two, in your slides, you had agile development on the left versus corporate environment is engineering. Are you saying agile doesn't scale in corporate environments?
No, I'm just saying that historically, large corporations, you know, believed for existing products, you simply could go into waterfall. Obviously, in large corporations, smart VPs of engineering, which you might be one, have adopted agile corporate environments as well. It was just that in large corporations, when you're doing sustaining engineering for sustaining products, you believe you could spec the features from end to end. And your first question was?
Bootstrapping.
Yeah, I think, again, this is not about the amount of dollars. It's the amount of information you could collect. And I will suggest that customer development works whether you have 10 cents or $10 million. You're just kind of constrained about the price of the airline tickets you could afford to get out of the building and talk to people.
Okay. Well, Steve, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we only have time for one more question. I would like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is with Steve, I'm sorry, with hit myself in the mic. Successful Strategies for Products That Win with Steve Blank. And Steve, I did want to know, with your book, Four Steps to the Epiphany, is there one big message from there? And is there a great story about epiphany you can leave us with tonight?
Gee, I still like all the people. I'm not sure I want to tell them, tell stories, though I will tell an epiphany story and a four-step story. First of all, in hindsight, by the way, only in hindsight, the book Four Steps to the Epiphany, the customer development process, agile development, etc., are only in hindsight now do I understand, and others are beginning to understand, is the evolution of a entrepreneurial management stack that's parallel to what MBAs learn on how to execute large companies. That is, we now, in the last 10 years, have a series of knowledge that has accumulated, customer development, agile development, business model design, user-centric design, entrepreneurial finance, etc., that is the equivalent of what an MBA would learn on how to execute or administer a large corporation. We have now started to collect the knowledge to teach entrepreneurs how to search for a business model. And so that's what I would say the four steps of the epiphany was. You want an epiphany story, or is that it?
Yeah, give us one more story.
So one of the things we did in the beginning of Epiphany is we spec'd our enterprise software. Epiphany was a company that, by the way, every VC I talked to hated the name. We'd fund you if you changed the name. It sounds too religious. And to me, the name was exactly what happened to a marketeer when they had an insight. It was an epiphany. So I kept the name, and they missed out on $1 billion in return. But in any case, our first products were really technology products. They were what was called an OLAP tool, a data mining tool, and a campaign management tool. But I, because I was the founder and understood the technology and understood large corporations' problems, could go into a company, understand that, oh, you have a customer profitability problem, draw on a whiteboard how to connect all the pieces, and I'd make a sale. And then I go into the next company, oh, you have a customer loyalty problem. And I draw the diagram of how this plumbing would connect to their different databases and how it would all work, and I'd make another sale. I said, hey, you know, I think we have, you know, some customer, you know, discovery and validation going on here. Let me hire our first VP of sales. And so she'd go out and make some sales calls, and after about a week, she came back and said, this stuff is unsaleable. And I went, well, what are you doing? She said, look, I present the products, and it takes me like 55 minutes to explain the technology, and then I'm out of the meeting. I said, well, don't you listen to their problem first? Well, no, you gave me the data sheets. And so I went out with her and realized that what was really going on is while the founder could describe the technology and do the product market fit, this was unscalable. And what I realized is the customers were actually asking for us to solve a series of problems. They were not asking for a technology. They were actually asking for, gee, can you solve a profitability problem or a loyalty problem or a customer retention problem? Now, by the way, you should know I spent wonderful money in naming these technology products, Clarity, Momentum, Relevance. Aren't they great names? Right? I mean, they were wonderful. They were shiny. The data sheets were great. The literature, I threw them all out. And we took those three technology products, same software, didn't change a single thing other than the data sheets, and called them Epiphany Customer Profitability, Epiphany Customer Loyalty, Epiphany Customer Retention. The salesperson went out with a slide, put up a list of 15 products, and said, which one of these problems do you have? They'd raise their hand, and they'd say, number one, number seven, number 12. We'd sell them the same thing five times. Our average selling price went from $350,000 to $2.7 million within 6 months. So that's my epiphany story.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I am Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. I want to thank our speaker tonight, Steve Blank, and his new book, Four Steps to the Epiphany. I also want to thank our audience here for attending and our listening audience at home. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.